Welcome back to MERS Monday. For more than 10 years, the Michigan Political Podcast. David Werthams, the Employment Policy Director for the Michigan Manufacturers Association, and Managing Director Denzel McCampbell of Progress Michigan, discuss their differing views toward labor legislation that's been flagged by the state's business community. President Stephen Rapundolo of MishBio explains why his organization opposes legislation to create a Prescription Drug Affordability Board, or PDAB, as well as efforts to remove certain immunity for pharmaceutical manufacturers. Also, conservative graphic designer Heather Dow shares how Patriot Post Girl was created. Now here's MERS reporter Samantha Schreiber, editor Kyle Malin, and the boss, John Roering.
Thank you, Mark Bayshore, for kicking off today's episode of the MERS Monday podcast. I'm your host, Samantha Schreiber, starting our weekly roundtable discussion. And let me just paint the picture. Legislation permitting local governments to set their own wage and benefit mandates. Bills requiring electric utilities to develop a 100% carbon-free energy standard by 2040, and proposals around paid family leave and the classifications for independent contractors have been flagged by individuals like Dave Werthams, the Employment Policy Director for the Michigan Manufacturers Association, as areas of concern for the business community, bringing risks to Michigan's business climate. Meanwhile, Denzel McCampbell, Progress Michigan's managing director, supports such ideas and what they can deliver to the quality of life for the state's labor force and the overall environment. The two have joined us today alongside MERS publisher John Roering, the boss, and editor Kyle Malin. Hey, David, how are you today?
Very good. Thanks for inviting me, Sam. I'm always excited to make this as my debut of the MERS Monday podcast.
Awesome. I love it. And then we also have another debut for the MERS Monday podcast. We have Denzel McCampbell. How are you, Denzel?
I'm doing well. Thank you so much for having me on. I'm very excited.
Thank you so much for joining us. So, Dave, last week there was a press conference hosted about various legislation that the business community is concerned with. Why was the Great Lakes Growth Coalition created, and who exactly are you all?
So the Great Lakes Growth Coalition basically is the Michigan Manufacturers Association, Michigan Chamber, the Detroit Regional Chamber, and the Grand Rapids Chamber. And as we were working individually on meeting with a number of the members of the state legislature, it occurred to us that a lot of the comments that we were hearing, really kind of came from the same point of view. And what we were finding challenging, particularly over the summer, is making sure that the message was being heard, was being received. And so we figured, well, we've been trying this now for 6-7 months now on our own. Let's come together as a group to really stress the importance of protecting Michigan's economic environment, and particularly in these four particular areas: the independent contracting, protecting the local preemption, or what was called the Death Star Bill on local labor regulations, making sure that our concerns about energy, the clean energy package, were heard, as well as concerns from the paid family leave proposal that was mentioned in the governor's speech. Just making sure that we were able to get our concerns to the table, so that as these policies move through the legislative process, the business community could be heard, could be a part of those discussions, so that we can try to make sure that Michigan stays good and strong for the future.
Denzel, I know that the Democrats have the majority in both the Senate and the House. You got the governor. And so there's this push to get as many things through as humanly possible. What from your standpoint, why the rush to get as many things through as possible now?
Thanks, Kyle. I think from the initial, from just a very basic standpoint, is that folks need these policies in place as quickly as possible. I mean, I think families across, working families across Michigan, want to see some type of paid or family leave program in place. You know, we need communities to have the flexibility to make those policies and worker protections when it comes to repealing the Death Star laws. At the very basic foundation of it is that folks have been really struggling, working families have been struggling across Michigan for quite some time, as we've seen policies such as Death Star put in place, as we continue to go be a state without some type of leave program in place for workers statewide. So at the very basic foundations that working families need this now, but also is that folks continue to demand to have these policies in place. And it seems that the people who are pushing these policies in Lansing, the elected leaders, are trying to listen to their constituents.
Dave, I want to ask you specifically, if the Death Star was repealed, what's the worst case scenario the business community is really afraid of? Is it prevailing wage locally? Is it, what is it?
For manufacturers, it is the nightmare scenario of a patchwork approach to the regulations in Michigan. 83 different counties, 535 cities and villages, over 1,200 townships would have the ability to set their own labor requirements. And if you are a small manufacturer who happens to have a larger footprint, even though you have 100 employees or less, and you have to keep in mind that for my association, 85% of our members are manufacturers with 100 employees or less. Okay, so if you're a small manufacturer, but you do have a larger geographical footprint, having to try to figure out how to navigate through all that patchwork of regulation, no two being the same. If I'm an HR person, I'm going to pull my hair out and definitely have high blood pressure at the end of the day, trying to figure out how to navigate that. That's the nightmare scenario. And what some of my members have been saying is that if something like that happens, then they will not just consider changing their footprint so that it either is not as large geographically within the state, but they'll think about changing that footprint to out of state, where there aren't as many regulations, where there aren't as many of a patchwork situation there, where it's easier to be able to provide those benefits that workers are looking for by having conversations with those workers, but without having 535 cities and villages, 1,200 townships interjecting themselves into those conversations as well.
If I can just, on the Death Star, I mean, what we had to really keep in mind is that the Death Star laws have just been around for less than a decade now. And, I think the sky is falling scenario wasn't happening before that. I think what we had was that the Death Star came into place where just the idea of municipalities setting standards around wages, setting standards around benefits and programs, really had a coalition of folks to come out and say, we're going to preempt that from happening and really prevent local elected leaders from making the decisions about the communities that they know best. And it really pushes out people in those communities from having a say in what they want to see happen in their community. I think, look, folks are rightfully pushing that we need to increase population in the state of Michigan and we need to bring folks here. And local municipality leaders are looking at that as well and seeing what other municipalities are doing in other states, that they're seeing growth and they want to implement some of that. The Death Star bill laws that are on the books would prevent them from doing so. I hear the concerns around, HR professionals having to deal with that, but if you are doing businesses in communities, I think you should have the respect of those local officials and those local community members to work with them and understand what are the policies that they want to have in place for their families and the workers in their local municipality.
I think what we forget is that when the preemption was put in place in 2015, there was a growing trend, a growing conversation from leaders in Ypsilanti and Ann Arbor and Benton Harbor, Marquette and Wayne County, wanting to have their own separate type of labor regulations. So it was a growing trend. I think the legislature wisely enacted the preemption because if you're going to approach those serious problems, whether it's about having a living wage, about what the benefit packages should be, about labor relations, then you need to make sure you have a standard throughout the state that people can count on. And that standard will help make sure that Michigan stays competitive. If other states do not have this patchwork regulation, then we will lose business here in Michigan. And if we lose business in Michigan, then people don't have jobs that will provide the benefits that they're looking for. So I think the legislature was wise in 2015, and we would be wise to make sure that if these decisions are made, they're made at the statewide level. So that you've got that standard there that throughout the state.
If I could break in here, Denzel, we got to give Progress Michigan credit for dubbing the term Death Star back in 2015 when this legislation during the Snyder administration first came to be. From your understanding, where did this come from? Where did you get this imagery from? And somehow it stuck. What do you know about the origins of how you guys came up with this?
Well, I have to give Sam Englert, our executive director, the credit for coming up with Death Star and the Star Wars reference in it. And really this we saw it as this bill that would really impact all of the work that was going on across the state. And look, I hear the conversation about the patchwork framework, but I live in the city of Detroit. We have a different reality for me as a resident, for me as someone who works in the city of Detroit, than someone who may work in, say, Flint, or someone who works in the UP. And that is the reality that we have here in Michigan. We have very diverse communities and different experiences that folks have. The benefits and what folks will need to have a leg up in those municipalities will look different. And while it may be that a standard across the board may look great for businesses to just have that and not have to answer to what communities need, that's just not what people are wanting in this moment. And that's not what people need in this moment. And what you have here is that on the reverse of that, if we don't have businesses providing the wages and worker protections that folks need in this municipality, you won't have people coming to these municipalities, and you will have people looking elsewhere for jobs that actually sustain the life that they need to put food on the table. We really have to be looking at what people are needing in these communities as well in this conversation.
I think Denzel actually highlights a point that is something businesses is experiencing. There's a fight for talent in Michigan right now. You talk to my members, we have tons of openings right now. And why do we have tons of openings? It's because people are looking for those benefit packages and that pay that meet their needs. The market is driving the conversation. The market is driving that competition. And if a manufacturer is not willing to provide those benefits in that community, then they're not going to get the talent to stay in business there. But if you start having a patchwork regulation and you start forcing different standards throughout the state, you will end up at the end of the day driving and creating basically islands of economic desolation because of this. And that's not good for the state of Michigan at all. So I think what we need to do, instead of interjecting local government into the conversation, we need to, again, have the floor set up by the state government and then let the market drive the talent to those areas, to those employers, so that and have that conversation. We will provide those benefits. We will provide that pay. We have to. Otherwise, we're not going to be in business because we won't have the people working for us.
And, you know, on that point, as we're talking about local governments, as we're talking about the folks that actually know what's going on in their communities, and we know that local leaders are looking, you know, if folks are looking at what's going on in the city of Detroit, and you may have, for example, if you use, let's say, Northville or Livonia, and they see what's going on in Detroit, and they may see that, you know, there are jobs that are going there, shouldn't those local governments have the ability to say, here's the floor that we're going to create to bring folks here, to bring those jobs here, and to also ensure that our workers and families in these communities are protected as well. If you have the standard across the board in the state, those local municipalities are not able to do that in the way that they have the tools to do so. I mean, you know, in the city of Detroit, they're creating a wages and standards board for the arena workers. And we heard from a worker at the press conference on the repeal of Death Star that wages and standards board, which has the folks from the arenas and the entertainment district at the table, doesn't have the teeth that it needs because of the Death Star laws. And these conversations won't be happening in a vacuum that does not have the business community in it. I'm sure local elected leaders will make sure that that happens. But the basis at how we're approaching the Death Star is that those conversations aren't allowed to happen right now, and they're being preemptive for having so. So workers, communities, and local businesses are left out of that conversation with the local elected leaders.
Before I change the subject, I do want to clarify, and I should have done this way earlier, that when we say Death Star, we're referring to the present day preemption that basically keeps local communities from establishing their own wage and benefits requirements. I really want to clarify that there is not a planet destroyer machine in the sky above Michigan. I felt very much like a Lansing creature just immediately saying Death Star. But
so you mean those satellites that were going around, that's not the Death Star thing?
I at least hope not.
But I do think, and Denzel, maybe this is because I've been around Lansing for a while. If I recall, the Death Star analogy came up because of the three kind of beams that created like the big... Here's where I show how I'm a geek. You got the three beams that created the main laser from the Death Star. And I think Sam was trying to point to prevailing wage, minimum wage, and I forget what the third one was, but that those are the three things that create the Death Star beam or something along those lines. But I'll let you guys go back in the history, figure out that one.
I promise to come back one day.
On the preemption itself, how many other states have a Death Star, if you will? Are we alone?
No, we're not alone. We are one of 44 states that have this.
Okay.
Now, I do want to talk about the independent contractor legislation, because while your coalition is concerned about it, Dave, I feel like it's not being as covered as some of the other components that you have listed. What exactly is this legislation?
So earlier in the session, a package of bills were introduced that would basically take what is known as the ABC test that they use in the state of California. This is a test that would determine when a person can be considered an independent contractor as opposed to a part-time or a full-time employee. And the test is written in such a way that it's so broad that it pretty much makes it impossible for anyone to be an independent contractor unless they find some way to get their a carve out in the law. And so if you take a look at what California did, and again, the introduced version of these bills are not the end version of what California did. It was the initial version. But since California introduced that, they've had over 160 exemptions that they put into their independent contractor legislation. They recognized that hearing from sign language interpreters, from accountants, from voice actors, from PR folks, from engineering consultants, environmental consultants, it was so across the board. And a lot of folks from the gig economy as well, your Uber drivers, Amazon, DoorDash, those folks, they were capturing all those folks that it really was more than they expected. And so what we have here in Michigan as the introduced version of that would capture all those folks, has no exemptions in there, and would be very problematic. Again, giving examples for manufacturers. A lot of manufacturers will actually use an accountant as an independent contractor when we have our end of the year audits for the fiscal year, whatever fiscal year member a manufacturer might be following. And those accountants typically like to have the flexibility of being an independent contractor because not every fiscal year is the same, and they're able to schedule their work based around that. Whereas this, if this bill was to be enacted, they would have to come on board as a part-time or a full-time employee, and they would lose out on the opportunity to work for more individuals who are looking for those services.
Now, Denzel, can you give us Progress Michigan's take on this legislation and the current state of independent contractors in Michigan?
You know, I think in this conversation about independent contractors and, you know, the ABC test that Dave spoke about, 26 states have some form of an ABC test that they use for this. And when we look at the use of independent contractors, it's not just accountants that may use this, but a lot of the gig workers that are being classified as independent contractors. And across the country, we've seen the independent contractors really be that system be abused in a way of that folks are classified as independent contractors and don't have the benefits that an employee will have, and they are having to really work for a smaller amount of money while these companies rake in a lot of profit around it. And across the country, we are seeing that folks just want workers to be treated fairly and feel that there's something like an ABC test, some form of ABC test in the state of Michigan will start to level that playing field for folks who are unfairly being classified as independent contractors. That's what this bill is about, to ensure that folks are being classified in the way that they need to be, and that that independent contractor system is not being taken advantage of. You know, what we saw in California is that people wanted some form of ABC test to be put in place. And then we had influence and money and politics really changed that. And a ballot initiative came up, and that was funded heavily by the folks who wanted to change the ABC system. I think, of course, I'm sure conversation will be continued to be had on how this will ultimately look. But at the core of it is that we need to make sure that workers aren't being taken advantage of, that if you are being classified as an independent contractor, it falls into what it was intended to be. But if you are someone who is working on behalf of that company and adding to their bottom line, and you don't, and you are being, the work that you're doing is as an employee, you should be classified as such. And we see a lot of folks trying to get around that. So I know this legislation is still in the committee aspect of it, but as that conversation goes on, we really hope that the workers will be at the core of the conversations.
Dave, one final question I had for you is the message that you guys are trying to share with legislative Democrats on the risk in doing too much of this agenda that we've mentioned here, the independent contractors, Death Star, energy, paid sick leave. What is the danger that you're telling these Democrats you don't really want to do all this all at once?
So it's a couple points. First is in the zeal to try to get things done in the first year of a two-year session, they're not necessarily bringing everybody who would be impacted to the table on this. And so I think a lot of the concerns that we have, a lot of just making sure I's are dotted and T's are crossed isn't taking place, that some folks who are out, who are not a legislator, but who are part of the system, part of the legislative process, might be able to see. And so we're asking them to slow down and make sure you get that feedback. When it comes to the independent contractor legislation, that was brought up without having anybody at the table. We're seeing, as the debate on the energy package develop, that as more people come to the table, it now starts to get flushed out. Instead of solely being focused on renewables, maybe it's more focused on clean. And that way, we're not forcing a policy that restricts the types of technology that can be used to accomplish and meet the mandates in the package. And so conversation is always a very positive thing. And that's part of our message. You have to include us early in the process, have us at the table, so that if this is something that's going to happen in this Democratic trifecta, it at least is done in a way that doesn't cripple Michigan's economic future. And that's the second part of our message, is we have to make sure that whatever decisions are being made today will not keep us from being competitive 5, 10, 15 years from now. We continue to see the North Carolinas, the South Carolinas, Tennessee, Florida, calling our members saying, you know what, we see what's happening in Michigan. If you come here, we've got a better economic development package for you. We've got a better economic environment for you. You can actually thrive in our state instead of going up there. That's what we have to make sure doesn't happen. We have to make sure that we can keep what we've got and grow up upon that if we've got the right environment here in Michigan.
So we are going over time here, but my final question for you, Denzel, is it fair to say that Progress Michigan is in support of all of these policies? And how would you describe the level of urgency right now?
Yeah, I think it is fair to say that we're in support of these policies. We're not shy about who Progress Michigan is. And we have seen that there's been decades of harmful policies put in place in the state of Michigan that have been anti-worker, that have been anti-voter, and really have harmed the communities that that are across the state. That's why there's a need for urgency on this legislation. Michigan is a place as that folks, it's a great state to live in, but we have a lot of work to do to ensure that our folks have what they need to put food on the table and live and have a thriving life. And that's just not when it comes to workers' rights and bills that impact employees. That's across the board in every aspect that impacts folks as we think about civil rights protections and others, right? And that's the message that folks should be sending out for Michigan, is that not only are we working on a legislation that will be pro-worker and ensure that workers are protected, but that we are pushing forth legislation that sees everyone for who they are and is welcoming for folks. And that's what I see the legislation working on. The fact that we have so much that to peel back and so much to work on, and we only have 2 years. I know 2 years sounds like a long time, but as we see, it's a very short time. We're already in October of that first year. We need to ensure that we get to work on those things. I would say the last point that I would make, as we're thinking about the Death Star laws, as we're thinking about family leave and the 100% clean energy, is that These are issues that are impacting folks today. On clean energy and climate change, we are already seeing the impacts of climate change right here in Michigan. We're seeing flooding. We're seeing extreme heat. That's only going to continue to increase. So we need to have bold action on climate change. We need to ensure that it's something that won't harm us in the long run of thinking that it is clean energy when it's not. And if we don't do so, marginalized communities that are already facing the impacts of climate change will continue to be harmed. And we're going to pay more in the long run. Everyone will pay more, including businesses will pay more to mitigate the impacts of climate change if we don't take that bold action today.
Denzel McCampbell with Progress Michigan and David Warthens with the Michigan Manufacturers Association. Thank you both so much for your time on today's MERS Monday Roundtable.
Thanks, Sam. Appreciate the invitation.
Appreciate it.
For this segment of the podcast is Stephen Rapundolo, the President and Chief Executive Officer of MishBio, which advocates for the biosciences industry, representing pharmaceuticals and therapeutics especially. Hi, Stephen. Thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Well, Stephen, I feel particularly bad because while we are pre-recording at 9:30 a.m. today, it's actually 6:30 a.m. in California, where you are. What are you doing in California this week?
I am at a medical device industry conference. It's the annual gathering of the medtech community, both here nationally as well as even internationally.
Now, before we dive into our conversation, talking about things like the Prescription Drug Affordability Board legislation, I'm a little bit curious, who exactly is MishBio and how are you all funded?
Yeah, so MishBio is now a 30-year-old nonprofit. We were established as a trade association that focused in the biotechnology base back in the early 90s, but over the years have now, we now represent the interests of biotech pharmaceuticals, medical devices, and other medical product technologies, all the research and testing sector, which includes academic and clinical research, environmental, industrial, clinical testing, all the sort of health tech, which is digital health and other health IT, the distribution logistics sector. So think of all the folks moving product around in those other sectors. And then lastly, the agricultural and industrial biotech. So think everything renewable chemicals, renewable fuels, nutraceuticals, that kind of thing. So it's a pretty broad industry, one of the top 15 in the country by size. We're the fifth largest med tech state. We're the ninth largest pharma state. So it has a huge economic impact and employs a lot of folks with very high-paying jobs here in Michigan.
Is your association more weighted in one area than the other?
Is it pretty even? Yeah, actually, it's fairly even. I mean, the med device sector has grown to take the lead, but not by a whole lot. I'd say it's about 30% of the industry footprint, followed closely by pharma and research, diagnostics, testing, which probably have a quarter each. And we've always been like that, fairly well-balanced.
And just to confirm, so are you all like paid or financed by people directly from the pharmaceutical industry?
We're a member-driven organization. And so at least, and so part of our revenue comes from that. Part of our revenue comes from things like programming. We also offer a group purchasing program to our members, and there's revenue streams that come from that. So no, we're a membership driven company.
Now I want to dive into policy. Obviously, this previous week, the state Senate on a party line vote approved the Prescription Drug Affordability Board legislation, the PDAB legislation, and it ultimately creates a 5-member board of governor appointees that would be able to research and then potentially set price caps on drug cost. Now, MishBio has taken an opposition position to this. Could you explain why you are opposed to PDABs?
Well, it's very simple. As you noted, you know, to establish a board that essentially would set price limits by way of a so-called upper payment limit or UPL for prescription drug prescription drugs. And really the salient feature, I think, of it all, when all is said and done, is that it really wouldn't do what it's in, supposedly its sponsors have intended it to do. And when we've talked with the sponsors, they highlight two specific things. One, the sort of the bad actors, if you will, in price gouging of prescription drugs. And we've heard those stories about the Martin Shkreli's and so forth. And then secondly, that they want to curtail or lessen out-of-pocket costs for patients when you and I walk into the pharmacy counter. And there's nothing in this bill that would address either one of those things. And so I think, you know, for us, it's rather disingenuous to put forward a piece of legislation that is not even going to come close to doing what it's claimed to be doing. It's a lot of political posturing and soundbiting, quite frankly, with really no means to achieve, you know, its intended goal.
I want to ask specifically, obviously the pharmaceutical industry has to be concerned if their drugs get too expensive. Is there an industry preferred method, a public policy perspective or approach that they would like the state to consider? Or is it more just you're kind of being defensive, preventing change that we don't want?
No, I think there are approaches that could be made, but they have to be done in a sort of a holistic approach, meaning there's a whole very complex supply chain made up of all sorts of other players in that, if between the time a drug is created and manufactured and put on the market to the time that you and I, you know, use it after the pharmacy counter. And, you know, I would argue that much of what they're intending to do with the PDABs, in fact, resides in the realm of benefits design. The list price that a company sets reflects, a myriad of factors, not the least of which that they have to negotiate and provide rebates and discounts to some of the middlemen like pharmacy benefit managers or PBMs, as well as the insurers. And none of those rebates and discounts at the moment get to the patient. And if we were to focus in that area, then, you know, your out-of-pocket, your deductible, your copay, and mine would perhaps be addressed. But that is not part of this. And it hasn't been in any of the other states where PDAP has been introduced. And so, you know, we would argue that if you really want to tackle out-of-pocket costs, you need to do it with all the essential players at the table. And you know, giving something up, making changes to ensure that patients do, in fact, walk out to accessing their drugs more affordably.
Your answer kind of leads me to another question. But lots of times during the formation of legislation, interest groups are brought to the table. Were you brought to the table by the Democrats before they've introduced this board?
No. And in fact, we weren't even initially going to be allowed to testify at the Senate PDAB hearing. It was only in the last, I think were we given 24 hours, maybe 48 hours, that we got notice that in fact they would allow a very, very small number. I think it ended up just being the two of us. There were others on the line that I know that wanted to speak and were opposed, but of course they had put a time limit on the hearing. And so they never had the opportunity to speak, although I believe their testimony was introduced into the record. And I was just going to say, and most of those were patient groups. There are a lot of patient groups that just are very opposed to the PDAB legislation, particularly those from the rare disease space.
It seems that the UPL is really zoomed in these opposition messages. And my question for you is, you look at Colorado, Maryland, Oregon, Minnesota. These are boards that are authorized to set those upper payment limits on drug costs. Does Mish Bio know of any drug manufacturers who are currently pulling out from those states because of such price caps possibly occurring?
It's way too early to tell. As you well noted, there are, I think, 9 states that have put in place PDABs. Maryland, I believe, is one of the oldest, going now on seven, eight years. Colorado is, of course, the furthest along. They just announced, the targeted list of drugs that they were going after. I know in one particular pharmaceutical company's case, they have been providing information to Colorado. But, you know, this was, again, the PDEVs are supposed to apparently target, you know, high-priced drugs that are have accessibility issues and certainly affordability issues. And yet the particular company's drug is not that at all. Its copays were, I think, $5 or less, hardly a unaffordable drug, and yet the PDAB decided to target it because it triggered another criteria. I think it was volume. And so, I mean, this points to another issue within the PDABs is that there's really no, they're fairly vague and ill-defined in how they're supposed to operate, what the criteria and the guardrails are supposed to be, both for the companies, but as well as for how the PDAB itself needs to operate. That has brought around some issues. I know in Minnesota, where they've slowed things down, they just voted theirs in May, and already the governor is slowing things down, recognizing that, you know, a lot of their language just really was not very well spelled out, and it's giving angst to a whole host of stakeholders. Across the board, the costs that have been estimated to run or operate these boards has just kept increasing. I mean, I think Maryland so far has spent well over $4 million. Colorado, I believe, has already over $1 million just in the last year, and they've gone back and requested more money. But none of them have yet really gotten to the point of defining and setting the UPLs. And that's because much of the legislation, I mean, it's all pretty similar across these states, have provided no guidance whatsoever. And it's from what we're hearing anecdotally in Minnesota, their people are reluctant to even want to apply to be on a board because of such vagaries in their roles. So it's a mess, which we've, you know, we have said time and time again to legislators. So.
But I know Maryland being kind of the oldest PDAP starting in 2019, but again, I just want to reiterate, it seems that there's this fear that manufacturers are going to pull out of a state, but it seems that no one's pulled out yet from Maryland. I guess my question is why aren't we seeing people leaving states? Why is it just kind of a waiting game? And with that being said, could things possibly not be as bad as what everyone's concerned about?
Well, I guess I would reply by saying they haven't pulled out because there have been no defined measures or placed or burdens or controls placed on. I think the minute that UPLs are set on a specific drug, then you'll see manufacturers probably have to make business decisions. You're starting to see that at the federal level as a consequence to the Inflation Reduction Act that was passed last year. Companies are, in fact, starting to shift their R&D portfolios away from small molecule drugs because the IRA sort of disincentivizes those and pushes things ironically more to the more expensive biologics. And so you're starting to see companies get out of particular R&D areas. And that's going to have a trickle-down effect. And that's what another one of our worries that we raised with in Michigan was, okay, you might be targeting a specific company or companies with particular drugs, but if they choose to get out or otherwise change up their R&D programs and whatnot, that also means they're going to be probably looking at mergers and acquisitions, which then impacts the small early stage companies, which we have a good number of in Michigan. And on top of it all, investors like venture capital and so forth, which these early stage companies rely on for their lives, will also perceive the market to be too risky and get out. And so now all of a sudden you're really impinging on innovation and a whole ecosystem is going to be threatened. And so I think in all of the states, certainly when I talk with my counterparts, we're all very concerned about that. Again, nothing has really happened because none of those states have really taken their PDABs to the point of specific things that have been, you know, put on the table that will require companies to consider their next steps.
Another issue, obviously, your membership is facing is the repeal, I believe, of the 1995 law that would provide drug makers immunity from lawsuits if their drugs were approved by the FDA. Can you explain to our listeners how that impacts your membership and why it's important?
You know, that piece of legislation was put in place to sort of try to address the risk potential for frivolous lawsuits. And what it has done is, I think, limited the level of potential liability, not only for manufacturers, but throughout, I would say, the healthcare system, insofar as if the drug has gone through R&D and manufactured and gone through FDA review, and the FDA, with all the evidence that has been presented, determines that it is beneficial and safe, then somebody could not come and they could sue, but they would have to prove that somehow the company was fraudulent or withheld information from the FDA during that review process. And the reason they, you know, what the FDA expects, of course, is information about safety in particular and around adverse effects. And if those adverse effects are noted, disclosed and then noted in the prescription drug labeling, then, you know, there it specifies to the patient and others what the risks may be. And so why then, would you allow somebody to sue when all of that has really been disclosed and they've accepted the fact that there are certain risks in taking that particular drug? And so that's been on the books. That doesn't mean that patients or citizens, individuals can't sue, because they can and they have, whether in class action suits like that was done with Vioxx. But it's, and then, you know, the other, I would also say on the flip side, or within the rest of the healthcare system, you know, if a drug is in fact sued upon, you know, I think providers, healthcare providers, physicians, such, as well as patients, you know, probably take note of that and are probably less, more reluctant to prescribe or to take that drug. And so it has implications on health and welfare of patients, when in fact the drug is actually beneficial and is the most appropriate for the patient. Remember, there's no drug out there that does not have some kind of risk. Well, I don't care if it's an aspirin or an over-the-counter drug or a biologic. Every drug inherently has risks, and it's the job of the FDA to ascertain that that benefit-risk ratio is appropriate for humans. And I don't think that the FDA's, you know, guidance and review should be something that patient should sue upon just because they may have had an adverse effect. That it would be very complex to prove that in fact the drug was in fact the culprit. It could be a lot of other things. So,
and to repeal the statute, the immunity statute, it received a initial hearing in the Senate Civil Rights, Judiciary, and Public Safety Committee earlier this month. And something that is consistently talked to by those advocating for the repeal, talked about, is that Michigan seems to be the only state to have this statute. And my question is, has Michigan actually gained anything? You know, what have we received because of having it in the last more than two decades?
Well, I'm not a lawyer, and I certainly don't follow, the case law or anything. So I don't know how many suits have been filed or not filed. Again, I would just, I think it does provide some stability in the liability realm for not just manufacturers, but others in the healthcare system. And yeah, I have not followed the any case law aside from knowing that, in fact, Michigan citizens did participate in the Vioxx class action suits. And that's really all I can say to that.
Are there any other issues this legislative session that you guys are particularly concerned about?
Oh, as one legislator told me, it's like a 5-alarm fire for the life sciences industry. We've talked about two. There's obviously drug reimportation has been reintroduced for the upteenth time. We've been battling bills that are meant to regulate the use of animals in research. We've been trying to push for the adoption or the establishment of a rare disease advisory council. So yeah, there's a lot of things cooking. Oh, and then next week, on a good note, for a change, you know, there's bills for R&D tax credits have been introduced, and which that has been our number one priority for a long time now, ever since that tax credit was sunsetted with Governor Snyder. So we're happy to see that on the docket.
I do want to ask a last question because we are kind of running out of time. And I feel like there's a ton of questions I can ask because there's a lot of policy things going on. But when I think about things like the PDAB, bringing this conversation full circle, and I talk to the sponsors, it seems to really be coming from a place of urgency that they have constituents that are rationing drugs, that are going over to Canada to buy drugs, et cetera. What is the reason for this? If someone had to ask you, why does my prescription drug cost so much? What does Mish Bio say?
Well, again, very simple as with what I started with. That is all wrapped up. The out-of-pocket cost that you and I pay is all wrapped up in benefits design. And if we really want to tackle the problem, let's start with what our deductibles are, what our co-pays are, things like that. And those are just simply not being addressed in any shape, way, or form, whether in the PDAB bill or anything else. Now, there was movement on PBMs. I'll grant you that. There's a bill that's been sitting mired in the legislature for copay accumulators. If they really wanted to have an immediate impact for patients, pass the copay accumulator bill. The patient groups have been screaming for it. Pass along the rebates and the coupons that the manufacturers provide and apply it directly to the patient at the pharmacy counter. And that's simply not being done with PDAB, and they haven't moved on it with the copay accumulator bill.
Stephen Rapundolo with Mish Bio, the CEO of Mish Bio, thank you so much for your time this morning and coming on the MERS Monday podcast.
You're quite welcome. Thank you.
Us for our next segment of the MERS Monday podcast is Heather Dow. If you have seen her graphic designs, you might know her as the Patriot Post Girl. Her designs have consisted of Governor Whitmer standing in as the Bachelor, handing out roses in a red UAW jacket with a Ford label on a cowboy hat. While critiquing the budget, she made a design of the governor working a deli counter with special project appropriations pinned to pieces of meat, saying we're all out of tax cuts. She's additionally made a Monopoly board graphic with references to Michigan's Corporate Incentive Fund, the Strategic Outreach and Attraction Reserve Fund, with cards being held by hand bearing a Barbie logo manicure. Heather, thank you for joining us today. And I think my initial question for you is, can you tell our listeners who you are and how did you even get into this Patriot Post Girl account?
Okay, so I started out when I first moved here about 5 years ago from Baltimore, Maryland. And when the shutdown happened, I was still homeschooling my son at the time, and I was getting more and more frustrated with what was happening in our government and just very frustrated about that. And so I decided I'm going to start trying to learn how to do graphic design all by myself. I figured it out. And I started really just doing event graphics and a few memes here and there, and I worked hard on it every day. And I just honed my skills, and I was having a hard time getting out, pounding the pavement to door knock and other things. So I thought this would be a good way to give back to the Republican Party.
Did you, when you say you taught yourself how to do graphic design, did you use any like certain type of like online class? Like, was there any type of specific training that you received, or was it kind of just going on Adobe Design and messing around until you got it?
Yeah, I just mainly messed around until I got it. I'm a homeschooler, so I'm a real go-getter. I went to a really artsy high school in Baltimore. And so I just had an eye for it. And I was self-taught. And eventually I learned how to make my stuff on my cell phone, which was huge. So I make all of my designs on my cell phone.
Wait,
Seriously?
Seriously.
Oh my goodness. So what do you utilize? Like, what type of app do you use?
Well, I usually use Canva, but I use the mobile app and I do everything on there mostly. That way I'm mobile and I can change things for people if they need me to on the fly. You know, if I'm at an event and someone wants a change, I don't have to be home to do it. So yeah, I've learned how to go completely mobile with my talent.
Oh my goodness. And how did you get involved with Republican politics in Michigan? How did you kind of enter that scene and who were kind of some of the big candidates that you would campaign for?
Yeah. So I've always been a Republican. I was a registered Republican in Baltimore when I was 18 and I've always been a Republican. But then when I moved to Michigan, I got really involved. I guess my launching off point was probably I was doing a lot of volunteering for Stand Up Michigan and doing a lot of their graphic design. And then I volunteered for Garrett Saldano during his governor run. And I've helped a lot of just grassroots people that needed my help. Like I said, I'm still homeschooling, so I didn't really want to be too committed. But I volunteered for a lot of different people and a lot of different entities. So,
okay. So for these graphic designs, how often do you post now? Because I feel like I see 4 of your designs getting posted to your Twitter every day. So how often are you putting things up at this point?
Well, I usually get up in the morning and I read all the papers. And so that way I'm informed because it has to be a visual representation of the news. So I kind of am trying to just meme the news from a Republican standpoint. And so that's basically what I do. And as the day progresses, I check the news periodically and try to get ahead of what's going on in the world, or at least what's going on in Michigan.
So when you think about your morning political read routine, what all publications are on that list?
So I read The Freep, I read the Detroit News, Michigan Capital Confidential. Sometimes I pick up the Midwesterner, MLive, Bridge for sure. They have a lot of interesting stuff in theirs. Yeah, so I try to touch most of the publications during the day and see if they have anything. And I'm trying to stay Michigan-based. Like, I'm trying to stay just local for Michigan because I feel like, you know, I saw a lot of the other side doing what I was doing, and I thought this would fill a need.
Do you think that, and I've heard commentary on this before, that for a while, it was very much Democrats really knowing how to strongly utilize social media. What do you think is the new game that Republicans must play to truly harness social media and things like what you're doing?
Yeah, I think graphics really grab an audience. And if you're not doing graphics for most of your tweets or for most of your Facebook posts or whatever social media you're on, then you're really losing. And yeah, I've noticed that. So it's important to think about your visuals when you're pushing a story out. Yeah, because it gets a lot more attention, because when people scroll, all they see is color and they stop when they see bright colors, basically, like that draws them in. So yeah, it's a huge draw. And so if you're not doing it, I think you're missing out.
Now, and do you get paid for any of this?
Not yet. I've just been volunteering my time for most of this time, like the last 4 years. And it's been very rewarding because I'm helping people across the board that, you know, are grassroots people that don't necessarily have the money to push out their messaging, but contact me and, you know, they need a meme, they need a cartoon, they need something to push their messaging out. And so I am willing to do that because I do see like such a need for this in our party. And I don't see a ton of people doing it. So I'm trying to fill that need.
How many hours would you say that you put in within any given week into this?
Well, I'm doing this every day. I would say it's fairly 9 to 5 every day. Monday, I would say it's all day, every day of the week, 7 days a week. And some of the stuff I pull from stuff I've made a long time ago and I just tweak it and that takes less time. But if I'm doing something from scratch, just a blank slate, it takes a lot longer. Some of the stuff that's very detailed can take, I don't know, 8 hours sometimes if it's super detailed.
Have you ever made a graphic design that you thought maybe went too far, or maybe you have kind of some regrets, like, I wish I would have looked further into that topic before putting that design out?
Yeah, I try to thoroughly research what I'm putting out. There are moments where I question myself, like, was that just pushing the envelope too far? I've really tried to stick with, you know, just I've tried to stick with like putting crowns on Whitmer.
You seem to go after Barbie a lot.
Well, I thought it was funny that the Whitmer campaign did that whole Barbie segment. And I just thought it was funny because the Michigan State Police pulled their Barbie down and said it was just it was not appropriate. And I actually agreed with the Michigan State Police when they pulled it down because I thought, you know, why are we aspiring to be Barbie? So I thought that was just not the greatest messaging. So I really ran with it. I've made several legislators into Barbies and senators. So it's been fun. It's been fun.
But then it seems like you've also had some people respond from the Democratic side. Like, I actually like the fact that you made me a Barbie with my own pink, like, electric vehicle. So hey, what's kind of your thought when you have that type of engagement where it kind of seems that everybody is kind of poking around at it?
Well, I think it's great that the Democrats all want a Barbie. I'm willing to do each Democrat as a Barbie. If you do something that I think is a little out there, I'm going to make you into a Barbie, most likely. So I'm running with that because I think that's a really fun way to get people's attention. I mean, if they pick that up and they run with it and it gets me attention, and then I'm pushing other stuff out about the economy, about, you know, the 100% carbon free plan. I mean, then they're looking at me for that too.
What is your favorite design that you've ever made?
Oh my, I have lots of them. I really like Barbie Whitmer in the paint aisle with the caution tape. That's my favorite one. With her COVID essential necklace. Her essential worker necklace.
And what was that poking at?
That was just poking at the fact that she shut us all down and said that we couldn't buy paint and seeds. So I thought I would definitely use Barbie for that, to push that messaging. And it did really, really well. So
I'm really curious to just kind of learn more about you and kind of your own personal values too, in the mix of all of this. I know that you talked about grassroots, and what is kind of your own personal definition of grassroots?
Well, I think grassroots are people that are just trying to make some change. They're not necessarily in Lansing, but they're seeing things in their own communities that are bothering them that they want to make change. And so I think it's important that everybody gets involved. It's not just people in Lansing doing the work. I think it's important to volunteer your time and to pick up a new skill if you have to, or, you know, like I can't door knock because I'm a homeschooler and I have other physical limitations. So I decided, hey, I'm going to find something else to do to help the Republican Party out. And so I feel like if everybody did that, if everybody picked up a skill set that was unique to them, then we would have a stronger party. And I feel like, you know, it just gives that like boots on the ground mentality. You have a society that's all participating.
If you had to pick a top three biggest issues that push you to the polls when you wake up and vote on an election day, what are your top three issues?
Definitely economy is the top one. And I mean, I moved here mostly for the homeschooling laws. So that's probably up in the top three, education. And let me see, what would my third one be? I think the third one would be just free speech for sure.
Now, in some of your graphic designs, you really talk about Michigan's population becoming more stagnant and people leaving the state. But one thing that I think is kind of interesting getting to know more about you is that you did come to the state 5 years ago from Baltimore. Why did you want to come? And you, of course, you did talk about the homeschooling laws, but overall, what was kind of that transition like, and you being drawn to Michigan, but now you actually utilize your platform to talk about people leaving the state?
Well, I came to the state, and I mostly came because of the homeschooling laws, and it was a lower cost to move here, to live here at the time. But as I've lived here for the past 5 years, I've started to notice things like crime, just things are going wrong. Crime is not good here where I'm living. The economy is getting worse every year that I live here. Cost of living is going up. Housing costs are going up. And it's just, I see the holes and I'm like, you know, I don't know if I can last here if I stay here longer than I am now. Like, I'm having a hard time staying here and watching the state just disintegrate a little bit each year that I've been here. And I came from a place where I felt like that was not a good place to live anymore. And now I feel like it's happening again to me. And I would prefer to not, I kind of moved here for a better life. And so when I'm watching things like this escalate, the crime escalate and the economy getting worse, and I can't fix up my house the way I want to fix it up because the money's not there, it's, you know, it's kind of depressing, you know? So I'm trying to just show everyone, hey, this is a problem. Population growth is a problem. We need to fix it. You're not going to fix it by battery factory jobs. You have to find jobs for college educated people to move to the state. You need to find jobs for just an array of people, not just one type of people, not just the middle class. You need it for all different, from the top to the bottom. You need to have lots of opportunity. And I just don't see that happening because, and I'm afraid that when my son grows up, he's going to move because he's going to say, well, I don't have opportunities here for me.
And do you just have the one son or do you have two sons?
I just have one son that I homeschool. Yes.
Okay. Do you have any family that was residing out here or what made your family kind of, beyond just the homeschooling laws, really just get home and get acquainted with this state?
Well, my husband's from here and he is from up north and he's from Manistee and he went to Michigan Tech, which was recently in the news for best free speech in the country. So we moved here. His family still lives here, but none of my family lives here anymore. Just my husband's family. So I'm, you know, all my family is from Baltimore. So.
How do you imagine your designs, what is kind of your strategy of how your designs might change as we dive deeper into the 2024 election year?
I'm really trying to focus mostly on the economy. I think that's a huge winner for the Republican Party right now. I think that affects everyone. Every single Michigander is worried about paying for their bills, paying for their groceries, everything they need. It's so important that we focus on that at this moment because I think it really does touch every single person. So that's my main focus right now is the economy.
Have you wanted to make maybe a graphic design for some of the Republican debates that have been going on, or are you kind of just staying out of that?
I really am trying to stay out of federal politics right now, only because I see such a need in the state. We have lost our majority in the House and the Senate. And I just think that if I can do my little bit of heart to get that back, I will do it. I feel like local politics is really calling me right now, as opposed to federal politics or the federal election that's coming up.
Could you also just give us a sneak peek of maybe some future designs that you have in the works?
So a lot of my stuff comes out the day of. I read the paper and a lot of the stuff I create the day of, which I know sounds kind of like, I can't believe she does that all in like an hour or two. but I do. I'm very quick at it now. But yeah, I usually, if you read it in the paper that day, it'll come out as a meme sometime that day. So I can almost guarantee that.
While you have this platform, what are some things that you want people to know about you as they come across your ex profile?
That I am just, you know, trying to counteract. I saw how the Democrats were doing a lot of the same stuff with the memes and the graphics. And, you know, sometimes they like to poke fun of me and say, you know, oh, she's on Gateway 2000 or something doing these memes. But I am just trying to fill a need because, I mean, they have that game down packed. And I think it's something that we can really benefit from as a party. And just really, I think people respond well to the graphics and to the visuals. Sometimes, you know, you read a story and you get confused, like, I don't know, I'm a visual learner. All I can see, I don't get anything out of that article. So if you have a visual, a lot of times people can respond better to a visual than just reading a story.
Why Canva?
Well, this is actually a very interesting story. I was volunteering with a group of people that were pushing a petition And someone had sent me the link, hey, could you help us do event graphics? And I was like, okay, I can try. I can do my best. And so they sent me the link to Canva, and I started working on it. And then I just got better and better at it. And I liked that it was a mobile app that I could use on my phone, and then I could take it with me. And that way, if someone wanted to change, I could change it on the fly and then send it, and I could just text it right to them. And that way they'd have it and they could throw it out whenever they needed it, as opposed to waiting until Monday. You know, I heard a lot of times people were having trouble because they were doing a lot of this work at the office, and they said, oh, I got to wait till Monday to give that to you. But I can do this anytime, any day. So that was the draw to it.
And what petition were you working on?
I was working on Repeal 1945 with Stand Up Michigan. That's actually really how I got started on this. Like I said, I was just frustrated with the shutdown. And even though I was homeschooling, it didn't affect me as much as it affected a lot of parents. But I really felt for the parents that were struggling with their children at home and had never homeschooled before, and were just trying their best to give their child the best educational experience at home at that time. And I just thought it was really hard on them. And it's obviously caused a lot of problems. Even now it's causing problems because there's a lot of learning loss. So
you actually pay for Canva too at this point, right?
Yes. Yes. There are things. Yes. So I pay for a lot of things myself. I pay for Canva, and I also pay for all my subscriptions. I have a subscription to Detroit News and the Freep and other ones that I try to stay on the up and up on all the news sources. So
do you have any additional things you'd like to add?
Well, I'm going to keep doing this as long as I can. And I am all about helping people, volunteering, helping people that are on the ground that are just trying to build something in this party, because I feel like this party is really actually struggling. You know, we've lost a lot this last year, and I'd really like to gain some of it back, some of these majorities back. And, you know, I'm looking to the future. I want to stay here in the state. And I feel like the only way to do that is to just contribute as much as I can to pushing the state in the right direction.
Well, thank you so much, Heather, for joining us on the MERS Monday podcast.
Thank you.
And that's going to do it for today's episode of the MERS Monday podcast. Thank you so much to our morning roundtable participants, Managing Director Denzel McCampbell of Progress Michigan, and David Worthams, the Director of Employment Policy for the Michigan Manufacturers Association. Additionally, thank you to CEO Stephen Rapundolo of MishBio and conservative graphic designer Heather Dow of the Greater Grand Rapids area. And as always, I'd love to give a tremendous thanks to MERS editor Kyle Malin and our publisher John Rurink, the boss. Post-production of the MERS Monday podcast is by Mark Bayshore Audio and Okemos. Thanks to him for putting this audio together. Additionally, thank you to AT&T for sponsoring this and all of our other podcasts. Until next time, I am Samantha Schreiber. Life is kind of crazy with a spooky little boy like